Welcome back to Troubled. Miranda here. Today's episode isn't really an episode. This is actually the audio from the Troubled Teen Industry panel that Naira had facilitated on October 3rd. We had the episode where we got to meet Naira, who's the nonprofit organization for youth rights, www.youthrights.org. Check it out. And Brian Connor blew my mind with the history of industrialized education in the U.S. So check that out if you haven't already heard it. But this is going to be the audio recording from that panel, which includes your favorite Amanda Householder, our Dark Knight, Senator Sarah Gelser out of Oregon, also Gabe Gonzalez with the Freedom Village Experience, our friends out of New York, and who else was there? Wayne and Shane and all those awesome people. So check it out in the show description as well. There'll be contact information for people. So please go give them some love and connect with everyone you want to connect with. But if you actually just want to see this, we did pop up the video from the panel on our YouTube. So you can go check out Troubled's YouTube if you want to watch it. Other words, keep on listening. It's going to pick up when Brian Connor is introing all of us. Hopefully this works as an audio, but you know, feedback is always welcome. So thanks you guys. And here we go.
She has created this TikTok account that's gone viral in order to expose them. And we have Miranda Sullivan, who is the host of the Troubled podcast, which interviews survivors of the troubled teen industry. And on their podcast, she's talked to people coming from all sorts of perspectives on this issue. We have Gabriel Joseph Gonzalez, who has been helping organize a lot of the different groups working on this issue, and specifically has done a lot of work with the Freedom Village Experience, the survivors of this specific boarding school, survivors of institutional abuse, or SIA, and Breaking Code Silence, which is launching a viral campaign right now, hashtag Breaking Code Silence, if you want to check it out. And again, for anyone who just came in, this session will be dealing with some very heavy content. It may contain mentions of child abuse, cults, brainwashing, homophobia, ableism, transphobia, sexual assault, death, and various other forms of physical, sexual, and psychological abuse. So if you would rather sit this one out, we totally understand that. And you can tune in again for our keynote speaker, Akilah S. Richards, who will be speaking at 2 p.m. on a post-colonial perspective on parenting. Although if you are okay with sitting through this session and learning about the troubled teen industry, we're glad to have you. So, to kick this off, I want to start off by giving all of you a chance to talk a bit about your story and your perspective, where you're coming at this issue from. And since there are six of you, I'm sure any of you could, and maybe some of you are, just write a whole book about this. But I'm going to give you each just 3 minutes to speak on this so that we can have a chance to hear from all of you. Just feel free to speak up, whichever of you is comfortable going first.
I'll go ahead and start. My name is Sarah Gelser. I use she, her, and hers pronouns. I'm a state senator in Oregon, where I chair the Senate Human Services Committee that oversees kids programming and kids residential care, foster care, mental health, developmental disabilities. I became involved in politics because my oldest child experiences a significant intellectual and developmental disability. So from the time that he was born in the mid-90s, I became very involved in the deinstitutionalization movement, first for people with intellectual disability, then for people with psychiatric disability, and over the last probably 6 years around kids residential programs. I certainly understand that there are times when people need acute care for a period of time, but I also believe that institutions are not built to serve children, adults, or elderly people. The troubled teen industry came to my attention first in 2015 when I learned about some issues with a residential foster care program in Oregon. That case ended up being investigated by the FBI. Kids were being sexually trafficked. They had to use paper towels to dry off. They had to steal tampons. It was just a horrible situation. So we reformed all of our laws around congregate care in Oregon for kids. A couple of years later, I learned that we were sending kids out of state to programs operated by UHS, Acadia, and Sequel, and became really interested in how they operated and why the state was skipping all of the protections that we had put in place in 2015. So we've been working on legislation and trying to work with other states to tighten this up, because it doesn't matter what state you're in, you shouldn't be abused when you're trying to get help or if you're in foster care. And I look forward to answering questions, and I'm grateful to get to be a part of a panel with all of you who I read and follow and just admire. So thank you so much for including me.
Hello, this is Shane Neumeier. Thanks for having me. I became passionate about this issue towards the end of my college education, reading a couple of books, and then especially getting into the autistic self-advocacy movement once I realized that I was autistic. And as autistic and ADHD people tend to do, I zeroed in on it as my area of focus. This is particularly of importance to me because I experienced, I would say, a much less severe level of coercive care as a young person, which, without going into the gory details, says a lot about the troubled teen industry, because there was some pretty fucked up shit that happened. But seeing what goes on in these programs, whether it's private programs that cater to generally upper class or middle upper class parents, like the one I went after in Oregon as part of a lawsuit against Mount Bachelor Academy, or the Judge Rotenberg Center in Massachusetts, which uses electric shock as a means of punishment on people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and is largely funded by New York State, which dumps its low-income students of color with disabilities at that and other abusive programs. The things that go on there are much, much worse than things I could have imagined let alone experienced. I worked as an attorney and a policy advocate in various contexts. For instance, I was involved in major litigation against Mount Bachelor Academy, as I alluded to before, out in Oregon. I also brought suit against the Judge Rotenberg Center for a case involving not shock, but extensive restraint and emotional abuse. And I have been advocating for ways in which to defund some of these programs, especially those of which that are taxpayer funded or largely so.
Hi, I'm Wayne Besson, the executive director for Truth Wins Out, and my organization has been fighting so-called ex-gay, pray away the gay, conversion therapy, whatever you want to call it, for quite a long time. And there are two things. There are the official ex-gay ministries and preparative therapists, which most people know about. And then there's an underground that we don't know about, and I would say this is the troubled teen industry. We can fight what we can see. The question is all these groups out there that we don't see. And that is what we have to address. And what percent of these groups or the damage and the abuse that takes place occurs from the groups that we don't know about? I would say quite a bit of it. We learned a lot about this. There was first the Zach Stark with Love in Action, who was sent there, and he sent out a message on MySpace and the whole world knew about it. And that got a lot of attention. And there was also 2020 did an expose, and also more recently, a couple weeks ago, A French documentary went over the story of Lucas Greenfield from the Saving Youth Foundation in Alabama, where terrible abuse took place, including throwing youth who were gay through walls. So the question to me in terms of addressing this is, what steps do we need to take to unmask, to discover all of the teen industry groups, because they don't advertise like the normal ex-gay organizations do, that we're going to help you change. But if you're a parent and you call and you say, I have a kid who's gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender, and you say, can you help change them? The answer in many of these cases would be yes. And those are the ones we need to track down and find and shut down, either through some groups right now, such as the National Center for Lesbian Rights, that's doing a great job, and Trevor, that's passing laws in some cases to ban reparative therapy. There were groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center with lawsuits that were successful against one organization, JONA. But there's so much more out there. It's like an iceberg. We've only really seen the tip, and we're going to have to explore everything below it to really be able to address and shut down these organizations in the long run. Thank you.
I guess I'll go next. My name is Gabriel Gonzalez, Joseph Gonzalez. I am a survivor from a facility called Freedom Village USA, which was located in Lakemont, New York. And I got involved in advocacy and speaking out due to the fact that the facility had announced that they were going to relocate in South Carolina last summer. And for the group that I belong to, we felt that they were not responsible enough and shouldn't be working with kids. And so we had spoken out against that facility. And then from that, we had learned about the troubled teen industry and really the network that these schools belong, and how close and how really identical these programs have, and also the habitual problems that and challenges that youth were facing in other facilities. We saw the same symptoms in Freedom Village, where they were sexual assault cases that are actually currently in New York court system currently, allegations of occult-like practices. Freedom Village was a religious school, and so they fell under the independent fundamentalist Baptist movement. And their therapeutic approach was a very thick layered religious application. And with that, they used that to break down the students there, and really had this culture that it seemed where abuses were constantly going on. So since then, I've been working with and discovered this network. Our focus with the Freedom Village Experience has been to really seek legislation. And our philosophy has been really connecting with our officials to really get them on the ball and track with legislation, which we think is very important, on the state level and also on the federal level as well. I'm also working with Breaking Code Silence, which is on my shirt right here. I'm also affiliated with them as well, and I'm repping for them doing this meeting as well. They have done tremendous work, and their campaign has really been amazing. And that's it to really sum it up real quick of me.
Thanks, all of you. Miranda or Amanda, when they go next?
I can go next. My name is Amanda Householder. When I was like 3 or 4, my parents started working in the troubled teen industry at a few different places. But it wasn't until 2015. I honestly had tried like changing my name on Facebook, and people still kept messaging me, telling me the stuff I already knew was going on was still going on. And so it got to the point I had already had my kids, and I could relate more to how I wouldn't want my kids to be treated. And so in 2015, myself and the survivors of Circle of Hope gathered together and basically started speaking out. It wasn't until 2020, this year, that we actually got on TikTok and went viral and actually did get their boarding school shut down. So now we're just working with ICU Survivor and Breaking Code Silence and the Troubled podcast to be exposing the troubled teen industry. So.
Can you guys hear me? Yep. Okay. So it's Miranda from Troubled. I think Brian did a great intro. I don't think there's anything left to say. I'm from the family school. That's the school I survived from. And I'm super off-grid, so I came to my neighbors and I'm plugged in through their front door. So forgive my amazing background on that one.
Great. Thank you all for being here. So Miranda, you talk a lot on your podcast about the history of this troubled teen industry. And I know you've done a lot of research into this. So could you explain a bit for the audience of where this came from, how it started?
Absolutely, my favorite topic. I know Jessica wanted to talk about Synanon, but I think that it's imperative, especially this week for those of us, Amanda brought up TikTok, saw that on September 30th, it's where Orange school survivors, especially the Canadian Indigenous, but talk about the tough love cult spawned from Synanon Project until we look at the roots of this. So with colonization in every country that this happens, they are going to assimilate, deprogram, and reprogram the youth that are culturally connected. And for a lot of us, I think we were taught that colonization and assimilation in the United States, or Turtle Island, which is what it should be where I am, they make it sound a very long time ago, and that's completely incorrect. In fact, the last residential school in the US closed in 1996. It was 1996 for Canada as well. In Ireland, the last mother and baby home closed in 1998. But I just want to bring up the fact that obviously at this point, the Synanon tough love thing is full swing. The tribes are sending kids through Connecticut into Elon at this point. And so they don't need to be overtly racist by having residential schools for the Indigenous. So it's really I want to make sure that we look at the broad picture. And this is a global thing, but a lot of us are really going to be focusing on what's happening in Turtle Island. So Canada and the US, because those are very much intermingled. With Synanon, you have Charles E. Dietrich, the class clown, everybody's favorite guy at AA, the best story that can be told. But that's not enough for him, because narcissistic egomaniacalities have to let run the cult, not just be the coolest guy in it. So he starts Synanon, which is about to be focused more on drugs, and they open this really cool hotel in California on the ocean. And so this drug return cult with forced abortions, forced sterilizations, removing children from the families, forcing divorces, and over 80 counts of gang assault on the community. And Synanon is considered America's most dangerous cult, but they were closed in the 90s. And Chuck E. D. didn't do any prison time because he had cancer at the time. And they were like, let's not do this to this guy. But by the 70s, you have the United States government funding its own behavior modification Synanon teen version, which is the seed. And then Congress investigated the seed in the 70s, right after it was started, and got the US government to shut it down and withdraw funding, because seed's still there. But then a year later, they're invested in Mel Sembler's Straight Incorporated. Mel Sembler came through the seed. So what we're looking at with this stuff is a family where you have one sick, twisted predator uncle opens up his own, and they're all connected, and the political and money ties are deep in Mel Sembler, as well as Robert Litchfield. Everyone's talking about Paris and Provo Canyon. Robert Litchfield started at Provo, and they had legal issues, and so that's how he started WASP. And Robert Litchfield is Mitt Romney's financial co-chair in his 2008 campaign. Mel Sembler, Straight and Kids Incorporated, the guy who came out of the seed, is Mitt Romney's financial co-chair in 2012. And so these connections are deep, but I'm going to yield my time to someone else because my connection is unstable.
Thank you. I know there are a lot of survivors in the audience here, but for those of you who aren't survivors, I'm sure hearing about this for the first time sounds pretty surreal and hard to imagine. I know it definitely was like that for me the first time I heard about this. So Amanda, could you talk a bit about what it was like growing up around this in this environment, in this culture?
To be honest, growing up in the environment, deep down inside, I knew it was wrong because I ran away multiple times. From the age 8, I tried running away. I tried committing suicide at age 10. So like deep down inside, I always knew something was wrong, but I was practically born into this. So at the same time, it's all I knew. So at the same time, it wasn't wrong, because no matter how many times I went to someone and said, hey, this is what's happening to me, this is what's going on, I was always treated and punished way worse for going to someone and speaking out. So by the time I turned 17 and they kicked me out, I was just done. I really didn't talk to my parents. I kept in contact with like the students. But anytime they would bring up what happened, I would basically tell them to shut up because it was my family. I just didn't want to go through it. And it wasn't until I had kids, to be honest. It wasn't until I had kids that I started realizing that this isn't how you treat kids. Like, no kid should be thrown to the ground and restrained for the slightest of thing. No kid should be starved. No kid should be locked up in a dark room screaming for days on end. So growing up in it, I knew it was wrong, but I was still in that, if that makes sense. It wasn't until I was an adult that I started really realizing and dealing with the effects of what actually went on there. And it's been a long, long journey, but I'm here now. Things are definitely better, and I'm thankful that we're all coming together now and exposing what's actually going on. So.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for talking about that. This next question is for Senator Gelser. From what you all have heard so far, it sounds like this should be a straightforward thing to combat. I mean, these facilities sound so obviously terrible, but there are lots of obstacles in place, which is why it's still an ongoing battle. And a lot of these obstacles are the laws that are in place that are kind of protecting these places. Senator Gelser, could you talk a bit about the laws that make it hard to fight these places and the work that you're doing to try to make them better?
Sure, thank you. I think that the biggest issue really is attitude and culture. Many of the laws in different states say that what happens in these places is wrong. But the regulatory agencies are not held accountable for holding the programs accountable for what they're doing. There is inadequate oversight. There is inadequate willingness to ask the second question, to look beyond what's just put out there. One of the things that we did in Oregon when we started with the program that I talked about before, it was called, of all things, Give Us This Day. And the governor and others asked, well, where were these kids' attorneys? These things can't happen. They're illegal. And it turned out that the Department of Human Services, including their director, knew that these things were happening. They knew that the staff wasn't licensed. They knew there were kids in programs that were not licensed. But I believe, and I cannot prove this, but I believe that they had been taken aback a bit by the aftermath of Mount Bachelor Academy, where they sued. Not all of the actions they took against Mount Bachelor Academy were upheld. The executive director of what was the Mount Bachelor Academy now works in behavioral health for the state in a county of all things, if you can imagine. But what it turned out that nobody was allowed inside these places, and nobody listened to the youth when they said what was going on, and the youth stopped telling people because they would just be labeled as troubled or troublemakers or exaggerating or lying or be put in jail. And in some cases, the kids preferred to be in jail than in these places. So the first thing that we did was said that there had to be unannounced visits to these facilities every year, a couple of times a year. Nobody could know that they were coming. The second thing was there's a whole set of people that have to be allowed access to the kids 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and all parts of the facility. If they don't do that, they lose their license. We created four circumstances that required the immediate revocation of a license. And that included knowing about abuse and not reporting it. We made it official criminal misconduct to work for the Department of Human Services and fail to take action on a licensing violation. We made it impossible to relicense a program if they weren't fully in compliance with what we called health, safety, and dignity practices. We also kind of increased the fines and the fees. Now, when it switched and they stopped putting kids there, they said that I had ruined the system by having these practices because nobody else would take these kids and that there were programs that shut down. The programs that shut down were places that hiked kids through the desert with no shoes on in August and left them there for hours with no water. That's a good outcome. They should close. But the argument is continually, there is no place else for these kids to go. And that's how these out-of-state programs are working. And, you know, 40 different states send kids to other states to avoid their own state laws. And that's why we need states to come together to have very strong licensing practices that don't just hold the programs accountable, but put criminal and civil liability on public officials that fail to maintain licensing standards. And I think I've hit my 3 minutes, but the one last thing I wanted to mention was that we also in Oregon created a separate definition of abuse for kids in care, and that includes private boarding schools. And among that definition is inappropriate use of seclusion or restraint. And in the next session, we are more carefully defining inappropriate restraint to include all supine, prone, and anything that kind of immobilizes someone against a wall, inflicts pain, does breathing, and that will allow those to be impacted as well. And we also have banned conversion therapy, but we've seen tricky ways that places are getting around that. And I'd love to talk to you more about that later, Wayne, offline.
Definitely. So next, Shane, I was wondering if you could describe a bit about what it's like working within this framework and within these systemic issues that Senator Gelser has described.
I would second what's being said about licensing agencies not doing their job. And pretty much what I've seen in my work is that licensing agencies have to be forced by other factors to get involved, whether that's litigation against the facility, whether it's a news story or series of news stories about what's happening there, whether it's a whistleblower who contacts the press or otherwise puts things out there and they catch on. It's usually that they have to have their hands forced by events. And usually, and I would like to see this change, it's not direct action against the state because that's very hard to do because of basically procedural issues. One thing I will put out there for any interested people with lots of money, I would be glad to have for litigation purposes, is New York State in particular, and some other states have a taxpayer standing law, which would allow challenges to how the state uses its funds or otherwise allow standing to challenge agency actions that might not otherwise be subject to random members of the public coming forward and bringing litigation. There are, besides tort litigation or civil rights litigation, which I've done in both the Oregon Mount Bachelor context, which was with a firm that specialized in litigating against child sexual abuse. I also did that in Massachusetts as a solo practitioner, filing both tort claims and under the ADA for disability discrimination against the Judge Rotenberg facility. Those can be very helpful. In fact, another person's lawsuit against the JRC in 2012 got the public the footage of the use of electric shock. We were able to finally see it in public. And let me say, even 4 years after studying this, it was horrific to watch, even though I knew what I could expect. And likewise, it can bring the full horror of an institution and how it works all the people and dynamics involved to the public so they can hopefully see how this happens. Whether or not it sticks is a different issue. That's one avenue. Another thing that one can do is go through, this is another thing where there's a divide between programs that serve more upper class people, more private facilities, and things for indigent people. I worked in a juvenile case involving a child requiring assistance in a juvenile court, and they placed this young woman in a foster care facility because of her acting out in at home and school because of her trauma. And it was maybe not to the level that Ms. Gelser described, but there were some awful things going on. And you can advocate for kids in the role of a court-appointed attorney. And I fought pretty fiercely against this one, against what was happening here. Unfortunately, it's one of those things where the presumption that this is for somebody's own good, and this is the only alternative, again, for these kids that have no other options, language that pervades this agency. And really everybody involved just either accepts it's shitty, but this is the way it is, so what can we do? That's the best we can do. Or, okay, it's not ideal, but the alternative is so much worse because these kids, you know? So it's fighting against that with the judges. It's fighting against that with the probation officers if the kid is juvenile justice involved. It's fighting against that with social workers. I had a social worker with this child who, when I brought concerns about restraint use in the group home facility she was in, my client was in, and said, how is this helping a young woman whose anger issues and behavior as a result of sexual, of being abused and raped by her father? The woman's response, well, she wasn't raped, she was molested. She needs to learn the difference. That's the attitude of people in the system. They are more concerned with what the child does down to how they describe their own experiences than what adults do to them. And they don't expect, I guess this is a good thing, they don't expect people to be really advocating from the kid's perspective sometimes. So there's a way to kind of shock them into seeing things differently. And in many cases also, though there are definitely some parents who are terrible about this and know what's going on and support it anyway, a lot of the times the parents either don't know or they don't have advocates who are saying, hey, this isn't right, I can fight for you and your kid. And so it's not only possible but worthwhile to get the parents on your side, because that can spur them to be like, oh, we can do something about this. This is not the only thing out there. So and as an attorney, you have to kind of keep your roles separate. You are the kid's advocate first and foremost, and that is the perspective you really should keep in mind. But if you can get the parents against the professionals or professionals doing this, then that can be a lot more power that you have behind you.
So Wayne, I know you've, I think been in this movement longer than any of the rest of us here, and have, yeah, faced a lot of obstacles in that time and also had some huge successes. So do you want to talk a bit about some of the biggest victories that you've had finding in this movement and how you got there? Oh, you're on mute.
I said, sort of, not in terms of the troubled teen industry, but in terms of, we did fight the ex-gay industry, and they I think, reached their pinnacle in 1998 when they launched a campaign that some say was $1 million, to say people could change through prayer and therapy. And I think my organization and a series of others fought these groups, and most of them went out of business around, you know, between 2010 and 2013. And a lot of the people that we fought against are now many of the counselors that tried to help people, which really ruined their lives, are now speaking out against it. And it includes Access International, Love in Action, which was part of it. The group Jonah was shut down by the Southern Poverty Law Center. We helped find plaintiffs for that lawsuit. And I think more recently, there's been some great victories in terms of prohibiting conversion therapy. And I think it's 20 states now, and at least 80 municipalities, groups like Born Perfect and Trevor that are doing good work on that. But I think in terms of the troubled teen industry, I think we have to get a handle on that. I wouldn't say there's much victory there right now, because I think I would say what needs to get done, you know, and I used to work, and I've been going back, I used to work with the Human Rights Campaign, the largest LGBTQ organization in the country. I think we need to, number one, get a handle on, of these organizations, how many of them actually practice trying to change LGBTQ youth conversion or XK therapy. So there's a way to do that, and it could be done through a scholarly effort such as a study, or it could be done putting in sort of an undercover operation where you just call, you get a list of these organizations across the country, and you contact them pretending to be parents wanting to fix your child, and how many of them say yes. Then you can get a handle on what the problem is, the scope of the problem throughout the country. And then once you can do that, you can do media campaigns to give them bad publicity and raise awareness. You can continue passing laws to prohibit the conversion therapy for minors, lawsuits. And I think another important thing to do at that point is to message against these religious exemptions, because we can't get around that problem. And I think it's going to be a challenge, parents can't say no to a blood transfusion for children. They can't beat their kids and say, I'm going to spare the rod and, you know, spoil the child. And so I think we have to stand up against that. At the end of the day, we can't get around that. And we have to say that, no, it's not appropriate to send kids off to camps where, and I mentioned the Alabama camp earlier, where they shave your head. The young people that were raped, they were thrown through walls. I mean, to sleep on cement slabs. No, that's not okay. That's not, no religion. Religion doesn't give you the right to do that to children. And so those are the different areas I think we need to focus on going farther. But I would just say, speaking from that, I don't think we have the full picture. And a lot of the work that you guys are doing are really bringing this to light and leading the way on this, and really showing that the scope of this problem nationwide. And I think we're very, very grateful for that. And I think we need the LGBTQ movement needs to really, I think, work alongside and do what we can to stop this. But I think we need to get a handle on how many of these groups are actually, and I would say a lot of them, but, you know, and maybe people can address that. What percentage of the groups that you've seen or deal with ex-gay or conversion therapy or abuse of LGBTQ youth? So we can kind of sort of get a handle on you know, what the task is in front of us to combat.
Right. Miranda, I saw you kind of brought up or were addressing that question from Wayne in the chat. Do you want to speak a bit on what you know of these statistics and such?
Well, I know that there's no actual statistics out there for anything within this industry. That's what everybody's really trying to get a hold of. You can look into the GAO reports. I think that's the most whatever. But yeah, so with survivors, we've never spoken with an LGBTQ+ individual who did not experience abuse that was related to their gender identity or their sexuality. That never happened. Every single specifically trans person that we've spoken to, whether they were in a wilderness program or an IFB Lester Roloff program like Amanda's dad's, their sexuality or gender preference or gender identity was absolutely brought up. Because this is behavior modification, and it's all about the child's identity, whatever that may be. And especially because this is paramount to the kinds of traumas that they're already dealing with, which are making them a target for these programs in the first place. I mean, absolutely. And Wayne had brought up a boy named Lucas, the ABC 2020. Please watch that. I think that that is a great way to get people really interested in this. And it does come from the perspective of an individual who literally escaped. And that's one of my favorite major news coverage, because they do like over 2 years of investigation and you get the whole story in that one. But his peers that are, you know, as like, I'm in Texas, so as like Texan good old boy as they come, attest to the fact that the gay kids at that program were excessively beaten, were stripped down naked, left in isolation. And, you know, this is regular. And my point's about Mount Bachelor, because I believe Mount Bachelor was also brought up. So sexual assault survivors, specifically child rape victims, are re-traumatized in these programs across the board. And then you're going to see specific groups like WASP that have specific ideas about like smushing, as an example. This is horrifying. Gabe is representing Breaking Code Silence. Hop on YouTube. Rebecca Mormon's Breaking Code Silence video is on Suburbia's Dirty Little Secrets YouTube channel. Please watch it. She's the sweetest thing you've ever seen, but she'll attest to the fact that child rape survivors, like everyone else, were forced into these cuddle puddles called smushing with these adult staff members who are child predators. My program, when people talk about not being as abused, I am the least abused ever. And my program from the outside and from the inside feels less extreme than some of the situations that our friends have gone through. But the reality is that my program, the Family Foundation School, was open for 30 years, and it was a magnet and a safe haven for child predators. There were multiple pedophiles at my program that I knew, and we all knew they were pedophiles, and they were fed kids. Our parents paid hundreds of thousands of dollars sometimes to have their children sexually assaulted, or in my case, have to create a manipulative way to avoid a big, fat, gross Music Man, check out that episode, who was raping my friends. And I knew it, and I was warned by another girl that I had to get out of choir before they put me in choir. And I didn't sing for years until we did that episode. I didn't even understand the trauma because he never touched me. I avoided him because of the courage of a child who risked everything to let me know that her abuser was waiting for me at my first day of choir and to get out of it. So this is across the board. They need to break the kids to build them up, is their kind way of putting it. And your identity, whether it's I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm an artist, I'm a whatever, has to be completely dismantled from everything in order for that to work.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Something that's been brought up a couple of times here, or Wayne, you kind of brought it up as a question, is this idea of parental rights or religious freedom, the idea that these facilities or that these parents of the kids somehow have a right to have this done to the kids. And somehow the idea that the youth themselves have rights just isn't in there.
We talked about what happened in the Alabama with 2020. There was a follow-up of the French documentary that came out a few weeks ago called You'll Be Straight, and they followed up what happened afterwards. It's just absolutely appalling what's happening with this. And, we've got to shut these things down, but I encourage people to see that documentary as well.
Oh, totally. Yeah. So people are sending a bunch of resources in the chat, but we can be sure to compile these and send them out to all of you, because there are a lot of documentaries that are coming out or in progress, and books, just a lot of resources.
What I wanted to add, I forgot, was that in that documentary, the French one, that the sheriff took all the information to the attorney general, which ended up being the senator for a while, Luther Strange. And his answer, this is disgusting, he actually said, we're going to allow this to go on, which included raping children. And Luther Strange, again, who ended up being a United States senator later on, when he was attorney general of Alabama, he said, oh, these parents that are sending their kids there, they don't vote and they're not from Alabama. And so we're going to allow this to continue. And he actually, because they don't vote and they weren't from Alabama, he didn't want to lose the support of the churches. They allowed this to actually happen knowingly and willingly. Unreal.
Wow. Yeah, so Gabriel, do you want to kind of elaborate on that youth rights perspective a bit, on that idea that, even though it's totally overlooked, like Wayne's been describing, these youth should have rights, like why, what's not happening there, or what needs to happen?
Sure. I want to also chime in and sort of touch base on what sort of Wayne and the senator and everyone else has been talking about, illustrating, really to understand what are really the challenges that the kids had faced on these facilities. So that we can have a clear understanding, what are these allegations? What are the extreme cases that we're talking about? And really, you know, in the religious institutions, the challenges have been with religious freedoms and the ability for these organizations to function and totally just opt out of regulations, giving them autonomy to regulate themselves and really define how these programs are really just the treatment of the students. So for example, with like Freedom Village, also Circle of Hope, New Bethany, and all these schools, the applications they use with such an extremist religious tone, where they broke down individuals, there were these punitive punishments. If you didn't follow what the religion was, you had to. And so a reference to rights as an individual, it was a brainwashing, a cult, more or less. And sadly, you know, those also allegations also that we're talking about, sexual assault, breaking down students, poor education, lack of health. The religious folks, sort of touching base with Wayne said, they have a tendency to, instead of, they don't believe in medication. And so if a young person is needed some type of treatment for whether it's mental health, they opt out of it. I think another good point to point out is that these are also private facilities. They're not for profit, and they're facilities that are making money off is wealth creation. And their product seems to be, in my opinion, like a fast food industry. And so the product is a very poor product. They because they're dodging regulations, they don't have a nurse in most cases. They don't have proper staff. They're not regulated. They're not giving the staff proper training with the state, such as how do you report sexual assault cases? How do you, they tend to internally, the students that are there, they pull from them to become their staff. And so now you have this cheap labor that's also of untrained folks. In the case of Freedom Village, that was something that was very typical. I would believe it's the same thing that was at Amanda's school as well, where you have a certain population of kids who all of a sudden are now putting the authority of other students without any training whatsoever. The challenges with youth rights, we want to ask the question, does the child have a right? Who has the rights, right? Does the parents have a right for the kids to be there? Does the kid have the right to refuse treatment? Or does the facilities have a right to have all of these kids? And so this is definitely an issue about youth rights. And this is something in our nation that we need to really, really talk about. It's really challenging. But from my experience and what I've seen and the stories I've heard, are horrendous. We're not talking about these places are dirty. We're not talking about these places are the food was bad. I think those things in New York City, for example, they would shut them down. We're talking about kids getting raped. We're talking about kids in punitive punishments, almost Nazi numbing treatments that they're giving them. And in the religious, which is like bonkers, we have folks who are just really taking the Bible and slapping around. We spoke about in Alabama about Lucas's program, and that's what they did. They beat the gay out of the kids. And the reason why I think we all here is we're all seeking for just basically better legislation to regulate this industry. And it's been a challenge because these programs are hidden. They're compounds that, you know, it's, you know, in most cases, people in even these communities don't even know they exist in their backyard. All right, I'll give my time because I think I went over my my limit.
No, no worries. But yeah, so since we're almost at, we've got another 10 minutes or so left. I know you've all touched on the work that you're doing currently. Know that we've kind of given somewhat of an overview of the issue, although, I mean, there's always so much more to talk about as of how deep this goes. But yeah, I was wondering if you could all talk a bit about the next steps you have planned and the work you're doing and how the rest of us, both the folks in the audience and the other panelists, can help with that and how we can all work together for the next stages of this movement.
I can go. Since speaking out with Circle about Circle of Hope, we got article after article written in the Kansas City Star. And because of that, we now have Missouri state legislators looking into fixing the laws in Missouri. She requested a hearing literally the week after she read the article. She requested a state hearing. Unfortunately, due to, I think it was COVID, it got pushed back. But we do have lawmakers looking at fixing the laws in Missouri. So we will be pushing and working with the lawmakers to at least fix some of the issue in Missouri. And we're not going to finish there. Like I'm working with Miranda from the Trouble podcast and a whole bunch of other survivors as well. Gabriel from the Freedom Villages to see that regulations get put into place. And so that's basically what we are working on this year.
I'm wondering for those of you that are working with lawmakers, like Amanda mentioned in other states, to the degree that you could help connect me with them, I would really appreciate it because I think we have built some good, kind of model legislation here in Oregon, and California has done some good work too in terms of transparency, not so much on the regulation, but they're transparent about what they're doing. Michigan is kind of the same. I think the other issue in terms of working together to move things forward, people don't believe that these things really happen. They sound too outrageous, too offensive, too scary for people to believe that they're real. And I seriously, people in my legislature truly thought that I was crazy, that I was losing my mind as I was telling them about these incidents. I was told I was sensationalizing things, taking a one-off kind of a thing. And people just don't want to believe that it's true and that we are paying for these things to happen. And so one of the things that we shifted to was realizing we need to elevate the voices of youth, survivors that were in the programs before, but also young people that have been there recently. You know, Paris Hilton has come out to talk about her experience in Provo Canyon. United Health Services, their response is what people always say, well, it's under new ownership. Well, I had a 9 and 10-year-old kid from Oregon there last year. We have restraint reports and records that say the same thing. We have to find a way to lift the confidentiality off of those so people can see what those look like. That's one of the only benefits of many of these programs starting to transition from troubled teen industry that targets wealthy parents to one that uses child welfare, mental health, and juvenile justice systems. We can get at those things through public records if we know how to ask for them. But we need to find them and get them and put them out and make people see them and put them out there, even though they're hard. People have to look at what we're forcing kids to live through. If we're telling kids they have to go there, we have to be willing to read it and look at it.
I wish I could say these days I was doing more than I am. Unfortunately, I don't have funding to work with, so I'm a little bit hamstrung as far as being able to do much. I've been writing some things on this that's gotten published. When I find documents, especially about Judge Rutenberg Center, I get them posted on sites that deal with that. One, a couple of things I'm looking to do is cultivate whistleblowers or people who could deliberately become staff members, as there's not much selectivity in these programs for staff members who can provide information. And if I could link them up with people who were prepared to defend them in counter lawsuits against the whistleblowers, that would be fantastic. The other thing, and everybody can do this point in part, it's not a lawyer thing, is filing Freedom of Information requests with state and federal governments. This can find abuse investigations by licensing agencies. It can find how many people are at different facilities in states that are licensed and where they're being sent from. It can find other contacts between agencies about specific programs. So, and sometimes they'll charge people for it. But one of the good things is that, one, if you work for a nonprofit, there are statutes that can allow you to get around the fees as a nonprofit agency. And two, because things are more and more digital, they can't charge you for the copying fees if they're just sending it by email. So if you're interested in this topic and want to help figure out more about what's going on now, what you can do is request information. Usually the agencies that do this are the Department of Education, the Department of Children and Family Services, or something along those lines. They have different names. Sometimes Office for Families and Children, there's a bunch of names. Department of Human Services, Department of Developmental Services, and maybe not necessarily, but Department of Youth Services for Juvenile Justice, especially where there are private placements of people who would otherwise be put into state institutions.
I'll just quickly add, I'm working on a new book right now to follow up on my first book about the ex-gay industry. And if anybody has interesting stories in terms of the troubled teen industry or anything you think would be useful for people to know in terms of the conversion therapy, LGBTQ issues, please contact me at wbestwhenthetruthwinsout.org. And I'd like to hear it because I'm... you know, I'd like to, the more information I can get out on it within this book, the better. So thank you and I appreciate it.
All right, I'll go. So Amanda had mentioned, we have a whole coalition of survivor groups that have been communicating daily. Like Amanda and I talk 3 to 5 times a day as just one contact for over a year now. Shout out to Sia and all of the advocates from the 90s that got us where we are with the GAO convention and shutting down our program and a lot of our programs. And also shout out to Amanda because her closing her dad's program from going super public to it close is the fastest that I've ever seen. And I think as Shane mentioned, ADHD brain means we're obsessed. So like those movies they mentioned, Fix My Kid especially, when I first saw that, I literally looped it for a week on my friend's couch with my therapist, Liz Iannelli, on the other line, like calling her chain smoking cigarettes. So do that. Check out our podcast, Troubled is Everywhere. Please leave us written reviews. Tell all your friends. If you want to get involved, let us know. We always have a lot of action items, so I'm going to try to keep it to three. Number one, the New York Child Victims Act that Gabe had mentioned, both the Family School and Freedom Village have tons of cases because we were just like, you know, little rape buckets for your kids, like really expensive, but a lot of fun. So we got lots of Supreme Court cases open. There was an extension because of COVID. But if you were ever sexually assaulted by anyone at any time in New York State, you have until January to file a case. This is the opportunity a lot of people thought would never happen. And there's a lot of people who don't know what's happening. And I really don't want to have those conversations with survivors a week, a month later, when they're like, I would have done this. And they're depressed from their inability to take action. So tell everybody, because you don't know who you know, like, qualifies for this. So let's get on it. Then also the DLC in Utah, the disability law firm, is doing a survey for all survivors from Utah programs. And as you guys know, Utah, because of its wilderness, because of Bain Capital, Mitt Romney, and all these guys, is a huge hotbed. And a lot of us at least did like a wilderness stint at one point. So let everybody know that survey is absolutely public. We posted it everywhere. So check us out at Talk Troubled on all the socials. Make sure that you fill those surveys out and pass them along. There's also, if you're in Utah and you want to participate in the Salt Lake Tribune's article, you can use their little Survey Monkey thing to get involved with that as well. And what was the third? Oh, mental health. Super important, you guys. Amanda and the girls from Exposing of Hope have set up a nonprofit. We do have Liz Ionelli is a survivor from my program and the founder for the IUCU Survivor Campaign. Please go to YouTube and check out all the ICU Survivor and Breaking Code Silence videos so that you can hear directly from survivors. But Liz and a lot of survivors, surprisingly, not surprisingly, have gotten into social psychology, which this was a social psychology experiment that didn't acknowledge what the Stanford Prison Experiment taught us, you know, and psychology. And so we need help both recruiting psychologists and psychotherapists who will either free or at low scale provide support for survivors and or patients for that. Please look up the Agape Boarding School, that one school alone that Amanda grew up in, that her dad worked at, and those boys are her brothers. They're dying. Like, you either overcome this or it overcomes you. And I just want to be really clear, a lot of us that are speaking here today and are speaking out the loudest, like, my suicidal ideation is still a daily thing. This is, I'm doing what I'm doing to literally trick myself into staying alive one more day by being completely obsessed with trying to end this. You know, we set little baby goals for ourselves like that. So, you know, connect with those of us that you want to connect with, but please do help us to like elevate this conversation and follow the White Rabbit as much as you can. But please understand, I know that these are things that are happening to kids and these are just our childhood memories, but these are also heavy trigger warnings, seriously heavy trigger warnings. So thank you guys for like facing the shadow with us, because, you know, we need your help.
I can go next if it's okay. The projects that we're working on currently have, we're continuing with, we wrote a letter doing COVID-19 we had worked with Naira on, really talking about the challenges that these programs had, and we had warned these controversial health practices that these folks had. We found since then a lot of programs were in complacence, and so we're continuing with that. We've been talking with Adam Schiff's office, Senator Sarah. I do recommend you do reach out to them. They, the congressman had said to us in August that they will be reintroducing a bill to regulate this industry. And we're hoping that they keep their promise on this. And so we're waiting to hear what their plan is and how they're gonna lay that out. But certainly, you know, one of our philosophies within our own group has been really the basic idea of just really going out and being connected to your community, connecting to your public officials. It's definitely beneficial in general to know who your city council member is, who your state senators are, and really address this issue to them and have a conversation. Our group, that's how we have been successful. I personally have reached maybe four or five congressmen and have spoken to so many offices about this issue. And, you know, they're willing to hear this. The reality is that if we do not create awareness, and the senator probably can concur with this, they have so much on their desks of ugliness to deal with and other priorities that they're not going to deal with this. They can't get to it. And so we really have to really make sure that this is one of the priorities, that at least that there's a dialogue going on, and they're really looking into these programs. Regarding breaking code silence real quick, I was told that there are going to be upcoming demonstrations publicly that they're planning to do. There are also our plans with doing a collaboration on ideas like a Bill of Rights, a comprehensive Bill of Rights of how youth should be in treatment, and something that we can present towards these facilities to adopt. Where Freedom Village experience, we're still exploring what's going on with the leftover administration. They had jumped from New York to South Carolina. We spoke out, shut them down, and then they jumped into Florida with their partners. And so they seem to be somewhat involved, and we're exploring what's really in trying to understand what's the challenges are going what's happening in Florida with them. And it's really, that's the gist for I think most of these groups that we're connected with. So reach out to your officials. I think that's the most important thing. Not only the senator, but as an individual, call Schiff's office, ask them what's going on with the bill. Call your own official. I'm in the district of AOC. I'm in New York City. I call her office. I called my city council member's office. And then also, Senator, we have folks in New York. Certainly, I would love to connect you with, because I think that they can support you on some level. And I think that also, you know, let's connect everyone together. There's a lot of folks, I think, who are, you know, the issue is that it's it becomes a state issue, and sometimes it's time for the next person.
Oh, I think everyone went there. We are at time now. Thank you all for being here. That was amazing. I definitely look forward to what comes next with this movement. And I hope this conversation between all of us can continue. You can feel free to stick around the next 10 minutes or so for more like informal chat. Audience members, feel free to chime in. Or if you all, I know you're all super busy, so if you have somewhere to be, you can feel free to head out whenever. Since we'll have people trickling in for the next session, I think we should keep triggering content to a minimum, or try to not mention stuff that could be re-traumatizing or anything for people who didn't want to attend this workshop and they're coming in for the next one. And then at 2:00 Eastern is when our keynote speaker, Akila S. Richards, will start her talk on a post-colonial perspective on parenting. I hope some of you can stick around for that. But for now, we can feel free to just stick on here and continue this conversation more informally if we want to.
Something to say about what Senator Sarah was saying. I'll turn on my video so you can see me. So one of the things we want to do is like build awareness. And I had the opportunity to come across one of the school contracts recently. And what was said in that contract was extremely manipulative to our parents. So there was a section in there from the Discovery Academy school, but I'm assuming they applied it in other schools as well. The contract said your child is going to at some point reach out to you for help, tell you that they're abused, tell you all of these different things, and you need to just remember to stick to the program because your child is lying to you. So our parents were set up from the administrators of the school to anticipate our calls out for help that we were being abused or whatever it happened to be. So I just thought that'd be important when you speak about talking about awareness, because still some of our parents, they don't believe us as survivors to this day, 20 years later. And so if you want to reach not only the parent community, but also the general public, that's just something to consider. That's all.
All right. Hope you enjoyed that. Hope it played out appropriately. It's just an audio file. Didn't want to play with editing anyone else's content. And I doubt you want to watch it after you just listened to it, but it's on YouTube in case anyone wanted to see our beautiful faces as we say all the words you just heard us say. So, you know, check out the show description, hook up with everyone in a totally respectfully platonic. I've had way too much freaking coffee. So I am signing out. www.youthrights.org. Thanks, guys.